Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Welcome to White Wine Question Time, Something from the Cellar. A chance for us to revisit some vintage conversations. And this week there's a theme. We're celebrating the Wonder Woman that is Hannah Waddingham. Oh, man alive, she has owned this year, hasn't she? I mean, she stole Eurovision. She's now got a timeshare with Christmas. She's sharing with Michael Bublé and Mariah Carey. After the release of her epic Apple Christmas special, Hannah Waddingham, Home for Christmas, which was filmed at the London Coliseum, somewhere that had a huge pull for Hannah because it's where her mother worked for 30 years as part of the English National Opera Chorus. And here we see her unpacking her extraordinary talents alongside the cast of Ted Lasso and the man you're about to hear from next. She invited him on stage and introduced him as a man who's been a friend for over 20 years, having started out with him in the West End. But you probably know him best as Hollywood superstar Luke Evans, who here recalls what it was first like establishing himself in the industry, from leaving home at 16 and saving up for his first singing lessons to working as a bouncer at London's hottest gay club.
Probably the most humble of jobs are the ones that educate you the most. Because without those jobs, and I'll list them in a minute, there's a lot of them, you don't know what it is to struggle. You don't know what it is to think about where your next rent is coming from. Saving money for the future. I couldn't do that for a very long time. I lived hand to mouth. And even though I was in musical theater, they don't get paid a huge amount of money. And I would do any job to survive. And I was never proud. I never thought, I can't do this because of who I am. I thought, no, you just do it because you got to pay your bills. And so I did. And those jobs, and you've mentioned a few of them, you know, I worked in a PR agency. I tried to get columns for celebrity chefs. Z-list celebrities.
I bet that's miserable. Taught you a lot about, even if it's just what you don't want to do.
I mean, the talented chefs were easy because they were talented and they were very famous, but the celebrities, which I couldn't even remember who they were now, but they weren't people I would have thought were celebrities. They were trying to, you know, think, God, I'm so much more talented than them. And I'm actually sitting here bloody finding work for them. You know, it is what it
That's
is.
That's brilliant. And yeah. You know what? You're right. You probably were more talented than them. As time has gone on to testify.
Yeah. But, you know, I would do anything. The mystery shopping thing, that was a miserable job because you'd have to go in and pick on somebody. Well, not pick on them, but just question everything they did as they served you. And I always used to give them 10 out of 10 stars. I didn't care. I got a free lunch out of it and they paid me 50 quid. So I was like, fine.
So you have to go and impose as a shopper and put the staff to the test and then report back on your findings.
Yeah. And that's sort of how it was. And then, you know, I worked on the door of a nightclub. I mean, it was the coolest gay club in London at the time, the Shadow Lounge, it was called. And I was...
You worked at Shadow Lounge on the door? No way.
Yeah, I was the VIP host. I probably let you in, my love.
Yes. Do you know what? I had a couple of really funny nights in there.
Oh,
one with Cilla Black.
I sat with Cilla Black several times. Paul O'Grady. Paul O'Grady would have been there too, right? Yeah, I used to let them in. And sometimes I said to Paul once, can I meet Cilla, please? And so he came upstairs. He's like, Luke, come on down, kid. Let me show you. Let me meet you. Let me come and meet Cilla. And I went down and sat with her. She was sozzled, I'm not going to lie. She couldn't put two words together at that point. It was quite late in the evening, but she was having a hell of a time. And, you know, but that place, you would let in everyone. Like, there were so many interesting people that used to come in there. Patrick Cox, Elton John, David and Victoria. I mean, you know, it was just one of those places. And I was there when it was at its height, you know, so, yeah.
So really, you were like the gatekeeper to the VIP lounge. The most sought-after gay bar in town, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, and I used to do that after work. So I'd go to the theatre, work in the theatre, I'd finish, and then I'd go and stand on the door till 3 a.m. just to make more money. And then in the daytime, I'd go and work as a PA to a restaurateur until 4:30, and then I'd catch the tube into the West End, do the show, and then go and stand on the door of Shadow Lounge.
Wow.
I worked and I didn't care. I wanted to save money because I wanted to... At that point, I'd signed with an agent in LA. So I'd already had big Hollywood agent and I was working three jobs because I knew without the money, I couldn't go to LA and live and spend 3 months there and go do all the meetings and all that, you know. I'm not too proud to not do work, no. You know, and because it was a means to an end.
I mean, what did those jobs teach you, though? I mean, apart from... the fact that, you know, you should never be too proud to put in an honest day's work. But, for example, though, you know, overseeing the door at the Shadow Lounge, you must have seen a lot that you took home and chewed over.
Oh, God. I mean, I usually would, by the end, by 3 a.m., you know, when I used to clock off, it stayed up until 4. God. You know, you'd be like, oh, God, why are you doing this? You know, you're freezing cold. You've had a fag butt thrown at your face. You know, somebody tried to bribe you, which you've let in. And, you know, you're drinking somebody else's drink that they've left at the front door because you're thirsty. And you think, God, do you know what it does, though? It makes you dream because some of those people I used to let in had made it and they were big stars. And I used to think, maybe one day, you know, maybe one day this is just a means to an end. But one day, maybe me, they'll let me into this place. I'll be on the other side and the red rope will be opened and I'll go in. And I don't know. I think sometimes work and not the job that you want to do in life is the thing that kicks you into wanting to fighting for the thing that you want to do. It's true. And I'm grateful that, you know, success happened at 30. Because at that point, I'd been living on my own for 14 years. I'd been surviving, paying my own tax and my own health insurance. Well, not health, but, you know, paying my income tax and since I was 16 years old. And so it wasn't easy.
You left home very young, didn't you? You were 16 when you went to Cardiff and then 18 when you arrived in London.
I didn't think it was young. I mean, I'd have left at 13 if I'd been allowed. I was ready to go. I was like, let's go. The bright lights of London are calling and I'm ready to go. But no, I had to wait till 16 and I had it all planned. I knew exactly what I was going to do. Get a job, start singing lessons and somehow find my way. And I found my way through my singing, which was the best way of going to London because then I had a purpose for being there.
Mm. See, most people think of you when they hear that you've got an album out as, oh, he's an actor who sings. But no, actually, you were a singer who then started acting. Singing is what you did first. And that job in the shoe department at River Island was a Saturday gig to pay for your singing lessons but you shared a singing teacher with Charlotte Church. But you were so invested in yourself, even from that young age, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. And I'm very proud of that 16-year-old. Yeah. I wish I could have just told that 16-year-old, you know, this is all going to pay off. Because I think at the point I was there, I just didn't have an idea of what was to come, you know. But every opportunity that was given me, I took. I never, ever stopped and goes, well, no, I'm comfortable here. And, you know, that's the unknown. I don't know about the unknown. I'm scared of the unknown. I was like, these doors are opening and they're going to close if you don't walk through them. And so I just did. And I'm proud of that 16-year-old, because that's a daunting thing at 16 to be, you know, firstly living on your own and then, you know, doing, just taking a singing lesson, then going to London for an audition and then packing your bags and moving to the big city, like without no one really telling you to do it. And, but I did that. And I was always so, I often wish like I could have been around for the 16-year-old Luke. Although the friends that I had then were amazing. They are still in my life. They were all good. In the audience at the show. I've known them since I was 16 years old. One of them I shared a bed sit with, you know, and there they are. I'm the godfather to her son, and they're still there. And a lot of the stories that I tell in this show are about my life and how I moved, and they were all part of it, and they're still part of it. And that's, for me, that means much more than any success, is that you hold on to the things that got you there. Because I feel that that's something that's very easy to forget in this business, you know.
God, yeah.
You get so much smoke blown up your ass. It's an American phrase, but I love it. It just makes so much sense. Yeah. You know, like, and if you're weak of character, you can very quickly forget who you were.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's good. I don't think it's healthy, you know.
But also I think fame and success is something that you handle, A, much better when you're older, but B, much better when you've worked and fought really hard for it. And we live in such a fast food sort of society now where you can enter a competition and be famous by the end of it, you know. I'm guilty of hosted shows like X Factor, which fast-track people to number one in the charts. But for
that was
you,
the last time I watched it, by the way.
Thanks, Luke.
You were with Leona Lewis, right?
That's right, yeah.
So when Leona Lewis was winning or was on the show, we were in Avenue Q and I was an understudy, so I was never on stage. So we used to be backstage with this little TV in the first actor's dressing room, which was right next to the stage. And we'd literally miss our cues because we'd be watching X Factor on a Saturday night.
That's hilarious, but you really...
Yeah. And one night, and the night that we all had to vote, I missed my cue because I was phoning and texting for Leona, like over and over and over again. And then she came to the show. Like, I was a big fan of Leona.
Next up, one of Hannah's Ted Lasso co-stars, a comedian, actor and writer, the hilariously unapologetic Ellie Taylor. In Ted Lasso, she stars as the rather aptly named Sassy, and she met Hannah on the show and they've become friends ever since. Here she talks about how she unexpectedly landed the role of Sassy and also dives into the success of her Sunday Times best-selling book that gives us a refreshing and brutally honest look at motherhood and the life-changing newborn stage. How did you end up on Ted Lasso?
Well, it was just one of those millions of auditions that I end up going for. And I can actually remember it because I was a bit pissed off because it was a very long way across London. And I was like, well, here we go. I'm going to waste half a day traipsing to the arse end of nowhere to do something and then not get the job, like always. Because obviously with acting, you just get a million no's. Went along and did it. And then, yes, got a yes. And that was a bit, what? Sorry, what? So that was lovely. And then it all, you know, had no idea what it was. No one did. Turned up to film my scenes and I still didn't really have a handle on exactly what the show was. And I'd only ever sort of seen, you know, I'd sort of seen my stuff. I didn't know what anything else was going on in the series. So when it came out on Apple again, it was, you know, no one knew what it was about. And I wasn't sure if I'd done that great. So I thought I won't mention it. I won't tell anyone that I'm in it. It's fine. Just let it go under the radar. And then everyone started watching it and everyone was talking about it. And then I was like, well, I should probably get Apple TV to have a look at this thing.
I'd watched it.
And then saw it and was like, oh, it's really good. And I was like, oh, well, I saw my scenes and I thought, oh, I'm okay. Okay. This is good. This is okay.
Really good.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I'm really chuffed with it. And it's just, it's just such a fun character to get to play. And it's such a lovely cast and Hannah is one of the best people I've ever met in my life. And that sounds like I'm exaggerating and being a media lovey, but she I think I'm in love with her. I honestly think she's like one of the best people in the world.
She genuinely is, isn't
amazing.
She?
She's amazing. I love her.
She's more than a triple threat. She just does everything.
And she's so funny and lovely and beautiful and interested in everyone and kind. And oh, yeah, let's just talk about Hannah for an hour. Let's do that, mate.
She's so talented. Anyway, we digress. How's the response been to your book?
Oh, do you know what? Really lovely, and I'm really chuffed. So, yes, so it's it came out a few weeks ago now, months ago. Anyway, it's out and it's doing well. I was Sunday Times bestseller. I can say I'm a Sunday Times bestseller. Stayed up there for 3 weeks, just absolutely delighted. And more than that, I mean, that in itself is, I can die happy, but the response I've had from other parents, mostly women, mums, have just been, it's just been amazing. And it's been so gorgeous to think that my book can act like, I don't know, like a little cuddle, like a little, like sisterly arm around you, like a good chat with a mate, especially when women are in the darkest bits of, you know, the newborn days. Mm. So my book sort of charts the story of me deciding to get pregnant when I wasn't very maternal, having pregnancy, having the birth, the newborn days, and sort of what your life looks like afterwards. It's sort of it's quite linear, really. But I think it's sort of the untold story in a way, because obviously everyone has a blooming kid. People are popping them out all over the shop. In that regard, it's really not a very interesting story. But I think,
well, not everyone, but you're kind of writing it for people that are sort of, shall we, shan't we, or
yeah,
I'm about to, or I'm thinking of doing this.
But I suppose what I'm trying to say is that it's such a common occurrence. Like, it's really not an extraordinary thing to do. It's the most boring, you know, mundane, predictable life choice that you can make. And yet, for every person who does make that decision, while it's as interesting as watching paint dry to everyone else, for you, having
when
a kid, it's extraordinary and your life implodes. And for me, it's the most profound thing that's ever happened to me. So I think writing a book about that very ordinary, under sort of underrepresented in a way, but also extraordinary experience is what I wanted to do. And yeah, to have women saying that, you know, they feel seen by reading it is wonderful.
That kind of brings me to one of my three questions for you, because you're known for being funny and your book is super funny because it's so honest. It's almost a bit like, oh my God, I thought that, but I don't know if I'd ever be brave enough to say it. So parking the funny, I wanted to talk to you about the honest bits, the bits that will provide proper comfort for people that feel like they can't say things out loud for fear of judgment. Mm. So if you could pick just two searingly honest passages from the book that you would sort of hope to hand to would-be parents as some kind of legacy, what would they be?
I would think the first one would be that the experience of having a child and loving your child can be completely separate. So you can love your child, or at the beginning for me, it wasn't really love, it was like, I liked my child. But that can be totally separate from the experience of hating the newborn period. I despised it. And there's a bit in the chapter, in the newborn chapter where I say that the newborn bit sucks. Fucking hairy, sweaty bum. It is absolute bullshit. And I wanted to leave my baby. I wanted to walk away from it. And I just wanted to have a walk around River Island and just have 5 minutes fucking peace, because the newborn bit is fucking awful. And I think to be able to say that, and to be able to say that if you are in it and you feel like that, it's okay. And if you are, you know, if you have a 16-year-old and you reflect back on your newborn days and you feel guilty because you didn't enjoy it, that's also okay. Okay, I release you from that guilt. It's absolutely fine and very normal. Don't beat yourself up for not going, oh, it was the most magical time in the newborn bubble. It's rubbish. A lot of it is absolutely rubbish. So that I'd like to say. And then I suppose also how sometimes you can...
Can I just ask though, just about that bit, like, you know, you say it's really, really rubbish. What aspects of it did you find so appalling?
Because I think I wasn't prepared for the mental adjustment that it takes to become a mum. It's not like you shoot out a child and suddenly you are Earth Mother. It's a real period of transition. So I learned subsequently a word called matrescence, which is in the same way adolescence speaks about the period between being a child and being an adult. And it's a process, and it's on a hormonal thing, and it's a physical change. It's something that cannot be reversed. It's the same between, you know, being a woman going through matrescence and becoming a mother. And that's not something I'd ever heard spoken about. And it rang bells for me because I was like, of course that was. I was in such a period of flux and felt so weird, and my body was strange, and I was trying to get my head around these strange new feelings and emotions and trying to work out who I now was in this new life. So I think that's what I found hard, in that I wasn't prepared for that. I was prepared for the baby won't sleep and you will be tired, but not really like what the real emotional, sort of psychological, I suppose, impact it would be on me.
Yeah, I described it at the time, in terms of my physical and emotional self, I felt like a stranger in my own head and body. And part of it, and it depended which way the hormones were blowing. So sometimes I'd run down the stairs to answer the door and I could feel my postpartum belly sort of jiggling as I did. And some days I could love it, for example, because I would think, my body's extraordinary. It's grown life. And once you watch a body come out of yours, I mean, seriously, that is mind-blowing. And you do have this massive, profound new respect for your body. And then the next day, the hormones could be blowing the other way, and you could just feel like somebody put a fat suit on you and you want to get it off and you just don't know who you are anymore. It's like being burgled and you try and put everything back as it was, but you still know that somebody's been in rummaging around and moved shit.
That is exactly it. That is so spot on. Yeah. I remember just being sort of sat in front of the telly with a baby feeding on me, watching like Gogglebox and being like, how can Giles and Mary talk about Bradley Walsh like everything is normal when my life has fucking imploded and I'm trying to work out who the hell I am? And I remember like being sort of running through things in my head, like, is this what I say? Do I say this stuff? Do I like that? Do you know what I mean? Like trying to play, you're sort of playing the character of who you were before while you transition into this new body. And yeah, the physical aspect I did find hard as well, because it's sort of, you look in this mirror and you've got used to this big, full, if you carried your baby, full of life, and there you are, you're so sort of vital and, you know, just swollen with, I don't know, you feel like a goddess. I'm speaking for myself. I know not all women feel like that in pregnancy, but that's certainly how I felt. And then afterwards, you're just like sort of deflated and wobbly. And I had a cesarean, so I had a big scar. And you just look at yourself in the mirror and just think, who is that? That's not my body. That's not my body.
Yeah, it just doesn't feel, I felt like, you know, like at the end of a 14-day holiday, the Lilo's on its last legs. That was my body.
Yeah.
It was like a defeated Lilo.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. And I remember like trying.
But then I'd hate myself for thinking that and think, you know, wait for the wind to change the other way. Because I think you are so hormonal, especially if you're breastfeeding and you get that massive rush of milk coming in and you're quite blue and you just don't recognize anything. You leave that hospital and you're like, no one's actually told me what to do next.
Now I know. Yeah.
Help.
Help. Exactly. Yeah.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Finally, we have EastEnders actress and Hannah's real-life best friend, Emma Bonn. Having worked with Hannah in the West End more than 20 years ago, Emma reminisces here about the wonderful friendship they've shared across the years, from Hannah seeing her fall flat on her face the night before their debut of a big West End show to being the person that Emma called to announce she'd been cast in EastEnders. Their friendship is one as iconic as the roles they've taken on. Emma, I can't believe how long you've been a part of the show. It is, I mean, it's 20 years. It's a lot.
It is crazy. And I think actually, going back to lovely Waddy Woo, I think she was one of the first people I called when I first got the job. So yeah, that was 2005. And it was a Friday evening. And, you know what the auditions are like, and you're going backwards and forwards. And it came down to myself and the wonderful actress, Nikki Wardley, who your listeners might know from like Catherine Tate show, and she's done loads of stuff.
Yeah.
She's just a gorgeous person. And I remember us going in on the Friday and we had to do a screen test in the Vic, and Perry was there and Shane Ritchie. And so we did our audition and went home. And Julia Crampsey, the casting director, called Perry and said, "Pal, we've decided to go with Emma." And he said, "Do us a favour, mate." He said, "Pick up the phone and phone her, because it's a Friday. She's going to be absolutely, you know, beside herself all weekend. Phone her now. Don't leave it till Monday. Phone her now." And she did. And because it's true, you know, when you're waiting on a job, it's all you think about. And you start, you know, fast forwarding, what if I get it, this is going to happen, if I don't get it, that's going to happen. So to get that call on that Friday, I think it was past 6 o'clock, past office hours, the agents are ready, you know, to go home. And I remember I was, I just was beside myself, and I just paced my bedroom, you know, for about 4 hours. And I remember calling Waddy, actually, and she was like, "Oh my God, your life's going to change." And God, didn't it?
That's exactly how she sounds. It's exactly how she sounds. That is a very good impression. Because at that time, I mean, how you would have known Hannah would have been through, what, the West End? Because, I mean, you were pretty prolific, as was she, and is she, in on the West End circuit.
Yeah, we met when we took over for the last 6 months at the Dominion Theatre, doing Grease, and she was cast as Rizzo and I was cast as Marty. And so we were replacing two of the actors in that, and we were doing the last run at so it closed. And we had about 2 weeks rehearsals. And so we just literally were together 24/7 for that 2 weeks, and we got to know, and we just literally, like two peas in a pod, we just got on brilliantly. And I remember, so we had a bit of lunch. So we'd done all our rehearsals. We were opening on the Monday, and on the Friday, you know, we had two dress rehearsals, and then see you later, in on Monday for the actual show. And so we had a little spot of lunch in a little cafe. I don't think it's still there now in Victoria. It's true what they say about karma. There was, and I've never done it since, actually. I have learned. There was somebody probably, someone we wanted to avoid coming towards us. I'm being very careful what I say here, because okay. He looked a little bit unsavoury, let's put it that way. And I sort of said something, comedy, to Hannah, but as I said it, fell off the curb, and fucked my ankle up royally. So
before you open the show.
Yeah. So this was on the Friday, late Friday afternoon. We were just about to go in for notes to say, "See you later, have a lovely weekend. You start Monday, you open." And my ankle just was like, boom, and just blew up. And that was me. I was done. So I was off the show for 3 weeks. I didn't have my opening night with Hannah. She took all the glory. I just had to go back in, retail between my legs. So I've never, ever done that since. I just, you know, never say anything a little bit naughty.
You face planted almost. That's comical.
Yeah, it was awful. And yeah. But we had the best time, and we're still like the best of friends now. So yeah, it was good times. Yeah, that was about 20 years ago. Crazy.
Blimey. And do you share the same sort of like mad, crazy excitement that I do watching Hannah's star rise? Because her talent is extraordinary, as you know only too well. But it's that brilliant showbiz story of that should go down in the sort of showbiz history books of sometimes it just happens. And, you know, your stars align and somebody comes in and speaks up for you and says, no, I want her. Like Jason Sudeikis did with her for Ted Lasso. And it changed everything. And now everybody gets to see everything we knew she had to offer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it opens the door for other performers from the West End. You're like, what she's doing is, isn't it just? And for a woman in her 40s, who's not a big marquee name at that point, absolutely is now. It's just marvellous, isn't it? And a single mum. I mean, it's like...
Yeah, everything. And she so deserves it. And the speech she gave, on, you know, when she won the Emmy and said, you know, please just remember us, musical theatre performance. Give us a chance. And it's wonderful how, you know, when we first met 20 years ago, the industry, you were sort of pigeonholed. You were, oh, you're a musical theatre actress and you're not going to cross over to TV and film. It was really difficult. But whenever I see her and you know, seeing her over in LA being interviewed and, you know, the award ceremony, I just sob. And it's lovely when I was doing Strictly, she would just every weekend, every Saturday, every Sunday after she'd watched the show on the Saturday, she'd always be in tears, just going, oh, you know, it's so lovely and your dress was so gorgeous. And so we've just got that appreciation. It's just and for each other. And yeah, it does give us hope. And so you should never give up on your dreams. That's true, isn't it?
You really shouldn't. And because what was so frustrating, I think, for so long was that stars of the West End, you know, the triple threats, the likes of you and Hannah that can sing, dance, act, would never get the opportunity to, you know, move out of their lane. It was very much you pick musical theatre or television or drama, you know, or film. But actually, then lots of people that had a profile from television and film could open a West End show. So they were allowed to kind of cross-pollinate your world, but not it was one-way traffic. And I think, you know, women like you and Hannah are proof that actually you can do it all. I mean, some of the stuff you've played in EastEnders has been gritty, heavy, heartbreaking. You can't do that if all you've got is jazz hands.
And I think deep down in I sort of knew that... I felt when I first started off, I wasn't, again, I've got quite a funny story to tell you. I wasn't the jazz hands. I trained in musical theatre, but I never thought I was good enough. So I had a great singing voice, but I didn't have the strongest. I could move, but I wasn't the best dancer. But I loved acting. And I sort of looked a dancery sort of West End sort of performer. But I loved doing comedy. So I was stuck in a really sort of hard, I just didn't know where to go and how to do it. I remember I did a lot of workshops for musical theatres and shows like that. But I knew I wasn't going to get that leading role because I just didn't think I wasn't in that bracket. So I thought I need to try and change. And get into straight theatre or into television. And it was so difficult, like I say, at that time. Mm-hmm. So we're talking, I would say sort of late 90s. And it just so happened I had the most wonderful agent, Barry Burnett, very famous agent. And I was so lucky to have been signed on by him from my showcase that I did finishing at drama school, and my teacher at the time wanted me to do a very beautiful romantic ballad that would suit a beautiful soprano singer. And I knew I was a bit more edgy. I don't think I could hit it off, but give me a character song. So I wanted to do Sondheim. I wanted to do Sunday in the Park with George. My teacher, musical theatre teacher, said, "No, it's hard. You won't be able to do it." And my singing teacher said she can and fought for me, and I did it, and I got Barry Burnett from that.
Thanks so much for joining me for another trip down to the cellar. If you want to hear any of these episodes in their full glory, and I recommend that you do, just search for Ellie Taylor, Luke Evans, and Emma Barton. And I'll be back on Friday with a brand new guest. Until then, thanks so much for listening.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.